parties at L.A. were often rather formal affairs. I offered one to you, who declined. "No thanks," he said quietly. "I have lung cancer. I'll be dead in 2 months." I immediately smashed my cigar out in an ashtray. I'm sorry, I said. I'll put it out. "Don't bother on my account," said Jewel, putting his hand on my arm. "It's too late for me." That night he looked healthy and powerful, but sure enough, within a few months, he was dead. I gave up cigars for a year or so after that, then went back to them, telling myself that Yule had smoked cigarettes, and I was smoking cigars, so it was so much less harmful. That was 2/3 of my life saved. Finally, in 2003, just before my 70th birthday, I was watching TV, cigar in hand, on my own in the office because the rest of the family couldn't stand the smell. On came the snooker player, Hurricane Higgins, speaking through a voice box and looking absolutely terrible, making an anti-smoking commercial. He had throat cancer. I put my cigar down in the ashtray, and I have not smoked since. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Yule. Thank you, Hurricane. And may your souls rest in peace. Don't be afraid of failure. I have found failure to be a great teacher, whose lesson is don't do that again. I took that advice many times, and I failed again many times, but always for a different reason. And failure can happen to anyone. I like to say that I have made flops with some of my best friends and some of the most talented people in the business. Norman Jewison, director of Fiddler on the Roof, In the Heat of the Night and Moonstruck, directed me in The Statement, set in beautiful Aix-en-Provence, but not beautiful in any other way. Oliver Stone, genius director of JFK and Platoon, directed me in The Hand, a horror picture in which the star of the show is my severed hand. Nora Ephron, writer of When Harry Met Sally and writer-director of Sleepless in Seattle, directed me in Bewitched, which somehow just didn't work. And Irwin Allen, the extremely talented producer of The Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno, was the first-time director of The Swarm. I was in a shanty with Peter Ustinov and Omar Sharif, in Curtain Call with Maggie Smith, The Jigsaw Man with Laurence Olivier, and Bewitched with Nicole Kidman. There were no recriminations. In fact, whenever I see Oliver Stone, he likes to say, "Michael, the best movie you ever made was The Hand." I got enormous pleasure from working with every one of them and spending time with every one of them. I had moments I wouldn't exchange for anything in the world, and we're all still friends. The only way to be sure you never fail is never to do anything at all. And the only way to really, truly fail is not to learn from your failures. And any time you learn from a failure, it's a success. Chapter 13. Being Decent. Being a decent human being is difficult for everyone from time to time, but it seems there are particular challenges for those who become stars in their worlds. In some ways, being decent becomes harder. Just at the point when your behavior becomes more noticeable and more important, harder, because once you enter the bubble of stardom, you can lose touch with reality and become demanding, egotistical, and unreasonable almost as a way of life. More noticeable because everyone is watching all the time. We love to know what famous people are really like. Do you lose your rag in an airport queue? Or did you take time out of your day to smile at a little boy, sign an autograph, and tell him to be good for his mum? Either way, whoever witnesses it will extrapolate an entire personality for you and tell all their friends. More important, because the more successful you become, the more your behavior sets the tone for everyone around you. Some huge stars completely lose touch with the real world. Frank Sinatra, for example, was an extremely generous member of the Secret Philanthropist Club of Hollywood, a circle of big stars who took care of less successful actors as they grew older and fell on hard times. And he became a friend of mine. But he was a law unto himself, and everything was on his terms. For example, Frank had a 20-minute rule. He would not travel for dinner more than 20 minutes' drive from his house in Beverly Hills. If he had been invited to dinner and had been in the car for 20 minutes, he would command his driver to turn around. "I'm 20 minutes," he would call out. "It's too far. We're going home." Mind you, he was also known to fly to Paris for dinner when he was staying in London, and he would always have people fussing around him. I remember once one of his guys whispered to me conspiratorially, "Frank's in a great mood today." I said, at normal volume. What about me? What about my mood? And the guy looked at me like I was crazy. Who cares? No one cares how you feel. I've known stars who have demanded private planes, drugs, full interior design for their trailers. It goes on. I was lucky. I always had my family to keep me grounded. There's nothing like your mum saying that she's had enough of LA and wants to go home to London to catch up on her favourite soap. Or your wife saying you want a cup of tea. Sure, the kettle's over there, to remind you that no matter how much adulation and validation you're getting in your professional world, at home you're just plain old you. Not a star, not a god, and quite possibly not the person who has had the hardest day. The other people who have always kept me grounded are taxi drivers. In fact, I sometimes think Shakira keeps a few taxi drivers on retainer just to stop me getting too big-headed. The other day I got into a cab to go out for dinner, and a driver, who must have been about 50, looked at me in the mirror and he said, "My grandfather loved you. He saw all your films." There was a little pause. "He's dead now." "Oh," I said, "have you seen any?" He said, "I don't think so." On the way back I got into a different cab. I saw the driver clock me in the mirror. "Hey, I know you," he said. I nodded encouragement. I was hoping something about how brilliant I'd been in Batman. Instead, he said, "Didn't you used to be Michael Caine?" Alec Guinness, that great British theatre and film actor, perhaps best known for his role as Obi-Wan Kenobi in the original Star Wars movies, but also acclaimed for his work with the greatest director of his era, David Lean, in films like Great Expectations, Oliver Twist and The Bridge Over the River Kwai, told me he had similar luck with cabbies. He once got into the back of a cab and the driver said, "I know you." Alex opened his mouth to confirm that he was indeed Alec Guinness, and the driver said, "No, no, no," he said, "don't tell me. I'll get you before you get out. I'll get your name." As Alex was paying the fare, the driver said, with a flourish, "I've got it. Telly Savalas." So Alex said, "No, that's not it." "I'll bet you wish you were, though," said the cabbie. Alec nodded with an Obi-Wan smile and walked off into the night. I still remember viscerally how nerve-wracking it was being an extra or a bit part actor, and still remember the encounters with my idols that made me feel like $1 million. Some like Frank Sinatra, Sidney Poitier and Gregory Peck eventually became close friends. Others took me under their wing and let me learn from them for the duration of a shoot. Noel Coward, for example, who did a hilarious turn as a gangster boss in Italian Job, was gloriously unstuffy, unfussy master of comic timing, who would very sweetly used to take me for dinner at the Savoy Grill every Wednesday evening when we were shooting. Noel had come from unpromising beginnings south of the river, worked hard, cultivated an image, and completely invented himself. He was an inspiration to me, and I couldn't believe I had the chance to get to know him a little. He was also a warm, witty, and wonderful dinner companion. I remember one evening we got on the subject of Vanessa Redgrave, who was in the news at the time because she was leading protests against the Vietnam War. "She will keep on demonstrating," said Noel, "but then she's a very tall girl and I suppose she's very pleased to sit down." When others like Sophia Loren and William Holden spoke to me when I had an uncredited part in their movie The Key, or Vivian Leigh, one of my all-time favourite actors, simply exchanged a few encouraging kind words with me. I only met Vivian once in 1966 on a memorable London evening when John Gielgud came over and introduced himself to me and told me that he and his dinner companion, a tiny woman in dark glasses, had just seen Alfie and loved it. The tiny woman whipped off her glasses and there, in living, breathing flesh, was Vivian Leigh. I was about to shoot Harry Sundown, for which I was going to need a Southern American accent. So I took a deep breath and seized the moment to get an acting lesson from one of my biggest acting idols. "How did you do your accent for Gone with the Wind?" I asked. Vivian smiled. "It's easy." She was being really sweet to an annoying young actor and gave no sense that she'd been asked this hundreds of times before. She said, "I just said four-door Ford over and over, only she pronounced it four-door Ford. So, if you think I sounded like Scarlett O'Hara in that movie, that's the reason why." I remember, too, some of the thoughtful little acts that made a big difference to a nervous young actor. When I was preparing to act opposite Laurence Olivier in Sleuth, there was one small, rather English matter that was bothering me. Formerly, Laurence Olivier was Lord Olivier. So, What should I call him? Was I going to have to address him, the only other actor on the set, as Lord Olivier? Or even more, medieval, my lord? Larry had the imagination and grace to anticipate my concern. He wrote to me before shooting began. You may be wondering how to address me when we meet, he wrote. From the moment we shake hands, I will be Larry forevermore. Whew. One less thing to worry about. Of course, I also still remember the other kind of encounters with big movie stars that left me feeling despondent, furious, or a bag of nerves. When I was a bit part actor, John Mills had me fired from a movie set for being too tall. I turned up to do my first scene with him, and he said he was sorry, but he couldn't act while he was looking up. He did at least insist I got my full fee, and we later became friends, and even acted together in The Wrong Box a few years later. Apparently, John was prepared to look up once my star had risen a little higher. Around that time, Oliver Reed and I got small two-day parts in a Norman Wisdom film called The Bulldog Breed. I was an uncredited sailor, and Oliver was an uncredited teddy boy. Apart from our dialogue with him, Norman never spoke to either of us, and in fact he ordered the assistants to keep the pair of us away from him. What a conceited, nasty man. Not funny at all. Elizabeth Taylor was delightful and utterly professional, but she had been a star since childhood, and the behaviour of her retinue when we started shooting Z & Co. together in 1970 almost gave me a nervous breakdown. Every morning we were given a running commentary on her royal progress. She's just left the hotel. The car's pulling up outside. She's in makeup. She's in hair. She's on her way. I made a point of treating everyone on set or on location equally, the stars, the unknown, the crew, the T-boy. On the first day, I introduced myself to everyone as Michael. I don't want people to think I'm swanning about, assuming they all know who I am, and I don't want people worrying, bloody hell, what do I call him, Mr. Kane, Sir Michael? It's hello, my name is Michael, to everyone. I don't pull rank. I much prefer to make friends with everyone and create a happy, relaxed atmosphere, to put everyone at their ease. I want everyone to feel I'm fabulous, we're all fabulous. I want the feeling in the whole unit to be one of excitement of our common endeavour. It's the right thing to do. It's also the best thing to do. I know that how I behave on set will make a difference to everyone's day and everyone's performance. If there's a young, inexperienced actor on set who's clearly nervous, I immediately go to work on them like some kind of nanny. I think back to what I would have wanted to hear back when I was screwing up my lines and knocking over the furniture, and say and do whatever I can to put them at ease. Tell silly jokes. Distract them with acting tips. Describe how I always used to mess up my lines. Reassure them that it doesn't matter if they do. We'll just do it again. I have even occasionally made deliberate mistakes so they didn't feel like they were the only ones. Encouraging young actors is not just altruism on my part, it's a two-way street, and the honour is often mine. At dinner for the premiere of Educating Reader in Hollywood back in the 1980s, my wife, Shakira, left her seat beside me to talk to a friend, and I found that a young man I didn't recognise had sat himself down next to me. "Excuse me, Michael," he said, "I wonder if you could give me some advice." I don't remember what I said, but we talked for about 10 minutes, and then Shakira reappeared. He jumped out of the chair immediately and started to walk away. "What's your name?" I called after him. "Tom Cruise," he said, opening his face into his trademark smile. That was the year that a 21-year-old Tom broke out in The Outsiders and Risky Business. So whatever it was I said to him, I'm sure he needed no advice from me. On the topic of extraordinary young talent, a few years ago, I was playing the part of Austin Powers' father, Nigel Powers, in Austin Powers in Goldmember. At the first production cast meeting, I met our leading lady, a very beautiful, very self-possessed, unknown to me, African-American woman, who I later discovered was just 19 years old. I started to talk to her, and she told me that she was in a singing group I had never heard of, and this was her first movie, but her ambition was to be an actress and win an Oscar. "Good for you, darling," I said. "What's your name?" "Beyoncé Knowles," she said. Beyoncé was quiet, observant, and completely professional, with a sensitive regard for the feelings of everyone else on the set. It was a pleasure and a privilege to work with this young star. And though I know her trophy cabinet is already heaving, I wouldn't rule out that Academy Award, not just yet. I've only once had anyone fired, and it was early in my career before I knew better. I was being driven to Pinewood the first day of filming on the Ipcress farm. The chauffeur, who must have been spoiling for a fight, opened up with, Are you the star of this film? I said I was. Have you read the book? I said I had. Biggest piece of shit I've ever read, he said. I was furious. I indicated that I would prefer to drive the rest of the journey in silence, and as soon as we arrived at the studio, I fired him. I recognize now that that came from a mixture of uncontrolled anger and insecurity. I'm not proud of it. It didn't make me feel better, and I have never done it again. I would never have anyone fired, but I am careful about who I choose to work with. Once when I was visiting New York, I went to the hotel suite of a well-known and very successful comedy actor to discuss a movie we were thinking of making together. He was going to be the star, and I was going to be the second star. I hadn't especially liked this guy on screen, but it was a good part for lots of money, and his hotel was next door to mine, right by Central Park, so I thought I'd at least meet him. I went into his suite, and he said, "Hello, Michael, have a seat." I sat down, and we looked at each other. There was a silence, which seemed to go on for a long time, although it probably didn't. Finally, the actor said, "It's not going to work, is it, Michael?" I shook my head. "No," I said. "I don't think you like me, and I'm afraid I don't like you either." He nodded. "It was a pleasure meeting you," I lied, and got up and walked out. For the most part, successful actors are not temperamental. The industry requires much discipline, 6:30 makeup calls and a lot of standing around while the cameras, the lights and the sound get happy. And sticking your nose in the air and insisting on special treatment is the kind of thing that leads to hammers and lamps falling perilously close to your head. But I do know one huge star who insists that no one can look her in the eye when she's working or start a conversation with her. Imagine the eggshells everyone is working on all day. I can't think they're doing their best work, even if she is. I've known another who had deliberately kept the whole cast and crew waiting all morning to make a point. I was working on a movie with a male star who was very jealous of his time while he was shooting. One day he was called on the set and kept waiting around. I forgot why, the light went wrong, the weather changed or something. One of those things that happens a lot. The following morning he sent a message to say, "Because you kept me waiting for 4 hours yesterday, I'm going to be 4 hours late today." There was nothing we could shoot without him, so we, the entire cast and crew, sat twiddling our thumbs for 4 hours. When he finally turned up, everyone looked at me to see what I would do. I think they were hoping I'd have a big row with him, and it's true. I was absolutely furious. But instead, I pointedly took him into a corner, put my hand on his shoulder and said, "I just want to thank you. I was out all night last night and I hadn't learned my dialogue. Now I've had a fabulous nap, I've learned my lines, and I'm feeling great. In fact, it just occurs to me, I'm going to a party tonight, so can you be late again tomorrow? That way I won't be the one getting into trouble." He wasn't late the next day or any other day. I don't like working with temperamental actors, and I try to protect my colleagues from them too. If an actor is having a tantrum and throwing their weight around on set, I go home until everything has calmed down. That is a big, expensive drag. It usually means that either they leave the movie or I do. And I have never left a movie. When you become a star, you enter a world where you can pretty much say what you want and usually get it. Stamping and screaming becomes, in fact, much less necessary. Some see it as a signal of their stardom. I see it as a signal of not quite stardom and insecurity, often followed by complete anonymity. Who are the nicest people to work with in Hollywood today? I'd have to include Sandra Bullock, Woody Harrelson, Scarlett Johansson, Charlize Theron, Jack Nicholson, Steve Martin, and Jude Law. They're all actors of huge talent, but beyond that, they're people you want to work with. They work hard, they have a laugh, they learn their lines, they don't upset anybody. Basically, they don't take themselves too seriously. Keep your temper. The irony of all this is that I have a terrible temper myself, but these days I never lose it, and I never allow anyone else to lose theirs either. The last time I blew my top on a movie set was in 1970, when I was making The Last Valley, directed by James Clavell and co-starring Omar Sharif. Last Valley was like many others of that era, a war movie, but with a difference. It was set in 17th century, during the 30 Years' War. I was playing the captain of a mercenary force, and unfortunately for me, that meant horses. My daughter Dominique was by now an expert horsewoman, and knowing my unhappy history with and sheer horror of horses after my Zulu debacle had given me some advice. I should ask for a docile mount and stipulate it should be a mare. Imagine my surprise and delight when I was shown my horse, the biggest I have ever seen, and very obviously a stallion. His name was something Germanic that was translated for me to Fury. No, no, I was assured when I raised a query. He's as quiet as can be, and was chosen with you in mind. I had a few practice rides, and Fury did indeed seem to be a gentle soul, until the first day of shooting, it was. I got into my costume and thought Fury and I would go for a little trot. The trot quickly became a canter, the canter became a gallop. Hanging on to Fury's mane for dear life, I really thought I was going to die. Eventually, we were brought to a screaming halt. It was me doing the screaming, by a jeep from the unit about 2 miles from the set. As soon as I got back to the set, I went apeshit at everybody, yelling and screaming until my voice was hoarse. Jimmy Clavell waited until I had shouted myself out, then dismissed the crew for 2 hours, sat me down and gave me one of the most useful lessons of my life. I was a prisoner of the Japanese during the war, he said to me, very quietly and calmly. And the reason I survived and others did not is that I never lost face. If you lose your temper in front of people you do not know, you are displaying a most intimate emotion in front of strangers. You look like a fool, and you feel like a fool. You lose their respect, and it is almost impossible to win it back. You must keep control. If you cannot control yourself, you look weak, and you have no chance of controlling others. And by the way, the reason your horse ran away was that your sword was slapping against its side. Every time he felt that sword on his side, he thought you were urging him to go faster. Now, you're going to have to apologize to everyone on the set. He was right. I did apologize, and from that time on, I have never lost my temper on a set, no matter what happens. I have also never got back on a horse, and nothing and no one could tempt me to do so. Actually, I did lose it just once recently. Daniel Radcliffe was doing an interview a couple of years ago about Now You See Me Too, a very funny heist movie where the robbers are brilliant magicians. When he was asked what it was like working with me, he said, I still seem to love my job despite my advanced age, and that the only time he got remotely irate was when a camera smacked him in the head. Even then, I only got angry with an inanimate object. I'd never, ever shout at anyone less powerful than me. It is not just about losing face. It would be hideously unfair. If you anger me or cross me, you will never see me lose my temper. James Clavell taught me that. In fact, you will never see anything because you will just disappear from my life. My parents taught me that. My dad taught me never to let anyone have two goes at me. And my mum taught me that the worst thing you can do to an enemy is to ignore him. To be angry is to be a victim. To move on is the only victory. Staying the right side of the line. For actors, there is one kind of scene above all others where it is most important to behave properly and treat colleagues with respect. The love scene. This is a fraught area for almost every actor and actress, and rich pickings for anyone intent on behaving badly. But in my experience, it is straightforward to behave like a decent human being. My approach has always been to stay as professional as possible. I abandoned my usual mantras to be prepared and be real, and I just kept things very respectful and very proper. I do not recommend getting together and breaking the ice before shooting. Rehearse, yes, if you must. But no one thinks that if you have a fight scene in a movie, you should go out and beat each other up the night before. And love scenes are no different. When I was making Alfie, my co-star Shelley Winters, with whom I had a lot of pretty racy scenes, appeared to take a different approach. I was a relative unknown at that point, while Shelley was already a big Hollywood name. The first time I set eyes on her, she was thundering down a corridor in the Dorchester Hotel in London, where we were due to shoot a location scene. It was 8 o'clock on a Monday morning, and I was just heading into makeup when I caught sight and sound of her and thought I'd introduce myself. "Well, hello, Michael," boomed Shelley, grinning widely. "I'm so pleased to meet you. Let's do it before we go into makeup, shall we? Otherwise, we'll have to get made up all over again." "Do what?" I asked, in genuine puzzlement. "Screw, of course," she said, eyes a twinkle. I always like to screw the leading man on the first day. It gets it out of the way. Otherwise, all that sexual tension can interfere with the performance, don't you think? I was frozen to the spot and speechless for a moment then. I turned on my heels and fled. As I did, I heard her laughter echoing down the corridor. She was just messing. I don't mess, but I do tend to make jokes at my own expense to keep the atmosphere light and to avoid the actress getting the impression that I'm enjoying myself too much. As soon as the director says cut, I'm out of character and making a joke to make it clear to my co-star that the passion is all an act. Elizabeth Taylor and I found an alternative approach. We compared our old scars. I had 2 and she had 6. One other little thing, born of experience. I carry mouth spray and have a quick squirt just before a kissing scene. The actress will usually say, "What's that?" And I say, "Here, have a go," and squirt her. That way, we're both covered. Most actors and actresses find love scenes, especially bedroom scenes, embarrassing. Most people I know get nervous. Julie Walters had a novel approach to dealing with the nerves. She once managed to con the entire shooting unit into taking their own clothes off by telling them that it was a new ruling from the Actors Union Equity. On Blue Ice, Sean Young had to do a nude scene and made the all-male crew strip down to their underpants. Don't try this in the office. There are exceptions, though. Glenda Jackson, who was my co-star in the 1975 British film The Romantic Englishwoman, and an extraordinary actress, not only always seemed in complete command of the situation, but she actually seemed to enjoy it. She walked around the set naked all the time, even when we weren't shooting the nude scenes. Didn't give a toss. There must have been something in the air on that movie, because actually Glenda wasn't the only one. On the first morning on set, another member of the cast, a young actress, came into my dressing room naked and asked me for a cigarette. I was married and scared. I said nothing. I just gave her the cigarette and lent her a towel for the walk back down the corridor. I've done love scenes with some of the great beauties and great actresses of my time. Elizabeth Taylor, Jane Fonda, Jane Asher, Shelley Winters, Glenda Jackson, Maggie Smith. I cherish these moments, but I've never become confused. I remembered that these women were not beautiful women who happened to be in bed with me, or not only that, but primarily brilliant actors who had a job of work to do, just as I did. And if I can stay professional in these situations, if I can see a clear line between what is and what is not acceptable, if I can behave when my office is also a bedroom, then everyone else can too. It's not that difficult. Those who claim it is are just not trying hard enough. I have to say, though, that the best love scene I've ever performed was as Alfred Pennyworth saying goodbye to Batman in The Dark Knight Rises. And I got to keep all my clothes on. Chapter 14. Don't Look Back, with a few exceptions. Writing a book like this inevitably involves some reflection, but until this point in my life, a principle that has served me well is to avoid looking back on my little life and keep facing forward. I don't like to mull over what's behind me. It's a waste of time, because there's nothing I can do about it. I like to plan ahead. I'm always making plans for the future, reading new scripts, planting new trees, and as I say to my grandchildren, don't look back, you'll trip over. When I'm shooting a scene, my concentration is absolute. I don't think about the last shot and what I could have done better. I don't think about the next shot and fiddle about with it in my mind. I give myself entirely to what I need to be doing in this moment. And then when the shot is done, it's done. I don't worry about how I looked or how I did. Once the director is happy, I wipe it from my mind and move on. It's a great approach, except when it comes to what's known as post-syncing. This is where sometimes months after the shoot, an actor is called back in to redo the voice for a particular scene. Maybe a dog barked, or maybe the director decided he wanted a different inflection. I've usually done another film or two by this point, and it takes a lot of work to remember my character, my accent, what I'm supposed to be feeling in that particular scene. I much prefer to get it right the first time. Leaving it for later can seem tempting when things aren't going well on the day, but almost invariably, it is a mistake. In the end, it's hard to work for a slightly diminished performance. So I focus completely on the shot we're taking now and try to get it right the first time. For similar reasons, I never watch the rushes. Why ruin today worrying about yesterday? Much better to spend that time getting it right today and preparing for tomorrow. Rushes are the bits of film from one day's shooting that are processed and rushed back for the director and others to look at to check things are going as they should. Although these days there is no processing or rushing, everyone can just head round to a little van behind the camera and view the footage as soon as it has been shot. I learned my lesson about not watching rushes very early on. When I was making Zulu, my first big movie, we were shooting on location in South Africa, and the film had to be sent back to England to be processed, so we had been shooting for 2 weeks by the time the first rushes came back. The rushes took so long that really they should have been called meanders. The stakes were high as the entire cast and crew crammed themselves into a screening room and the projectors whirred into action. My heart was pounding and my palms were slick with sweat. The screen flickered and was filled with a huge pink face, which I realized to my horror was me, while someone else, also me, started droning on in a ridiculously clipped British accent. Behind me I heard a titter, and then, "Who told that silly bastard to pull his hat down over his fucking eyes?" The hat had been a carefully planned piece of characterization. I decided to wear my old-fashioned peaked military pith helmet low, shading the top half of my face for most of the time, and to tip my head back to allow the sun to catch my eyes when I wanted to make a particular point. Bitterly disappointed that my career was going to be over so soon, I ran out of the room and threw up. I wasn't involved in shooting the next day, so I spent it tying myself into stomach-clenching knots. That evening, I decided I had to face the music and go down to the hotel bar to let Cy Enfield and Stanley Baker tell me I had been fired. By the time they arrived back from the day's shooting, I was a couple of drinks in, with a couple more lined up on the bar. "Hey, not bad, kid," said Stanley as they breezed by. "Don't worry, you'll get better." I just stood there and looked after them with my mouth open. So, no more rushes for me. I don't want to screw up today's work and tomorrow's, worrying about yesterday's, and I don't want to focus on what it looks like on the outside when the performance has to come from within me. I want to be in the moment now, getting it right from the inside. And it's not just that. When the rushes go well, that can be an unhelpful distraction too. You have to remember that just as all I saw in Zulu rushes was my own big sweating head, everyone else was seeing only their work. If you ask makeup how the rushes were, they'll say, "Wonderful, her eyeliner looked amazing." If you ask costume, they'll say, "Amazing, the colours on that shirt really pops." And actors can get so fixated on the rushes that they start performing for each other. Harry and Walter Go to New York was a comedy starring James Caan and Elliot Gould, with Diane Keaton and me in supporting roles. Diane was like me, she didn't go to rushes, but we would sometimes sit together in tense silence outside the screening room, straining to hear whether there were any laughs. All through the shoot, everyone was so pleased because everyone in the screening room never stopped pissing themselves. They would come out almost sick, they had laughed so hard. But when real people saw it, there wasn't a single laugh. James and Elliot had been cracking each other up and having a great time, but no one else seemed to get the joke. Everyone can convince themselves that because they have done their best work or their co-star cracks them up in the movie, it's going to be a smash. But it doesn't work like that. All too often, people buy their yachts after the rushes and go bankrupt at the premiere. Plus, if you don't go to the rushes, you get home earlier. The moment I hear cut, rap, I'm off and away. I never regret anything. I always said that when I'm old, I want to be sitting there regretting the things I did, not the things I didn't do. And now I'm old, it turns out, I don't regret anything at all. Every project I've done has brought me something and has added to the richness of my days. I had fun, and I'm still having it. There's no point in looking back on a flop and thinking, if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have done it. I didn't know then what I know now, and I couldn't have. I made the decision in good faith for reasons that made sense at the time. And probably I know now what I didn't know then, only because I went ahead and did what I wouldn't have done if I'd known. So I've learned something. If I was given the chance to live my life all over again, I would do everything the same and remake every single one of my movies, from Alfie to The Swarm. I had fun. I made wonderful friends, I went to exciting places, and I worked with some of the most talented people in the business. About the only regret I allow myself is that I never got to make The Dresser with Orson Welles. In 1963, I was playing the lead in Next Time I'll Sing to You, a theatre role. that indirectly played a key part in the launch of my film career by bringing me to the attention of Stanley Baker. It also attracted other interest. One night when I was on stage, I couldn't help noticing very strong laughter coming from the middle of the stalls. I was so struck by it that I tried at one point to look out into the auditorium to see if it was someone I knew. All I could make out in the gloom was a rather heavy, middle-aged man sitting on his own. After the show, I was in my dressing room and there was a knock on my door. I shouted, "Come in," and turned round to find the great filmmaker, Orson Welles, standing in my doorway. He said some kind things about my performance, which I found somewhat overwhelming, and off he went. We stayed in touch, and many years later, Orson approached me about a project he thought we should do together, a film based on a stage play about the relationship between a hammy old actor, to be played by Orson, and his devoted gay dresser, me. I knew and loved the play and said yes immediately. I could see that it would be a tremendous vehicle for both of us. Alas, it never happened. Albert Finney and Tom Courtney had already bought the rights, and they made it into a wonderful film, for which they were both nominated for Academy Awards. Just a few years ago, it was remade for the BBC with Anthony Hopkins as the old actor and Ian McKellen as the dresser, and it was wonderful all over again. I still sometimes think wistfully of the Orson Welles Michael Caine version that never got made as the best film I never did. Don't let the past control your future. When you hold a grudge, you're allowing your past, or worse, what someone else did in the past, for reasons that might have nothing to do with you, to dictate your future. What's the point? What a waste. Alfred Hitchcock and I became friendly when I was making Gambit at the Universal Studios in the mid-60s. Our bungalows were next door to each other. At Universal, you didn't have dressing rooms, you had bungalows. And of course, we were both South Londoners. His family had a shop in Towerbridge Road where my maternal grandfather had a fruit store. But the friendship didn't last. Alfred offered me the part of a serial killer in a movie called Frenzy, and I turned it down. It was so brutal and disgusting, I just didn't want to do it. Alfred made the movie in 1972 with Barry Foster in the lead role, and he did very well, but he never spoke to me again. It wasn't just we lost touch, or that happened with a lot of movie friendships. A couple of years later, I was filming in Berlin and was walking down the Kurfürstendamm when I saw Hitchcock walking towards me with a group of people. He saw me and he looked at me, and he very deliberately turned his head away and kept walking. I didn't think about it much at the time, but it came back to me a few years later. As I mentioned before, when we were living in L.A. in the 1980s, one of the favorite restaurants in Beverly Hills was the great Hollywood meeting place, Chasen's, a great place to name drop. One Sunday evening, Shakira and I were having dinner there with Frank Sinatra and his wife Barbara, Gregory Peck and his wife Veronique. I looked across the table, and just to the right of the door, there was Alfred Hitchcock. I smiled at him and raised a hand in greeting. He saw me, he looked at me, and he very deliberately turned his head away and kept eating. I kept glancing at Alfred, sitting on his own through the rest of the evening. I reflected then that in Hollywood and elsewhere, if you stop talking to everyone who disappoints you, Vanessa Redgrave and Helen Mirren also turned down parts in Frenzy, you're deliberately compounding the disappointment, and you certainly don't end up at many dinner parties. I'm very careful about the grudges I hold. I would never dream of holding a grudge for such a thing. Look at Irwin Allen, who directed me in The Swarm and Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. Talk about disappointments. But I would never let a professional disappointment come in the way of a personal friendship. Irwin became a very dear friend to Shakira and me. He was a generous, warm, fabulous human being, and while we lived in L.A., we used to eat at Chasen's together most Thursdays. For me, it's about trust. If you break my trust, we can't stay friends, and we can't work together. If I'm going to let something from the past control my future, if I'm going to cut someone out of my life, and I occasionally do, it will be about trust. Because once there's a little weakness in that particular cloth, it may tear at any moment. Beware of retreading old ground. Remaking movies is a form of looking back that, in general, I would not recommend. Several of my movies have been remade in the last couple of decades, with limited success. In 2000, my friend Sylvester Stallone remade my 1971 gangster film Get Carter, with Sly himself starring in my original role as Jack Carter, and with the action transposed from Newcastle in the rainy northeast of England to Seattle in the rainy northwest of the United States. Sly asked me to come and do a walk-on part as Cliff Brumby, the big man played in the original by Brian Mosley, which I did think it would be fun. It was, but reading the reviews, it was not. In 2003, F. Gary Gray did a good job of remaking The Italian Job with Mark Wahlberg in the role of Charlie Croker, and Charlize Theron, the very beautiful and talented actress who I'd worked with on the Cider House Rules, stealing the reviews in a new role. And in 2004, Charlie Shire made Alfie, starring Jude Law. Jude is a wonderful actor whose 2009 Hamlet was one of the best I've ever seen. I love Hamlet, and I've seen a lot, including Richard Burton's in 1964. He did a terrific job with Alfie, but there were a couple of problems. The 2004 audience was less forgiving than the 1966 audience of Alfie's immature and selfish antics. And at the end of the movie, Alfie says, "What's it all about?" My Alfie looks bewildered, but Jude's Alfie was more intelligent and self-aware than mine. The moment you see him, you can tell that he knows exactly what it's all about. The movie did not make money, and its reviews were mixed. Despite these red flags, I got involved with the remake of Sleuth in 2007, because in my mind this was not really a remake. It was a complete reinvention. What was more, with a brilliant writer, Harold Pinter, a brilliant director, the wonderful Kenneth Branagh, and a brilliant co-star, Jude Law again. Harold completely rewrote the script, with not a single line of Tony Schafer's original remaining in his version, and Jude completely reinvented the part I had played in the 1972 original. Why, I deliberately did not go back and rewatch the movie before taking on the Olivier role. The plot, the characters, setting, and the ending were all changed. We worked our hearts out, but the critics were disappointed that it did not improve on the 1972 version and slammed it. We would have been better off moving just a little further away from the original and billing it as an entirely new Pinter piece. Although it is tempting for obvious reasons to remake big hits, I've concluded from painful experience that it's the wrong approach. In remaking good movies, you're putting yourself in a no-win situation. The remakes of Get Carter, Alfie and Sleuth were all great disappointments, as was the 2012 remake of Gambit, my 1966 movie with Shirley MacLaine, which, despite great writers and a terrific cast, went straight to DVD. They could hardly fail to be. They had a lot to live up to. In contrast, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, the Frank Oz movie I made with Steve Martin and Glenn Headley in 1988, was a huge hit. It was a remake of the 1964 movie Bedtime Story starring Marlon Brando, David Niven and Shirley Jones, which despite its excellent cast had been a flop. It just hadn't been funny. That meant that the remake could not be a disappointment, added to which we reaped the benefits from everything the writers Stanley Shapiro and Paul Henning had learned from what didn't work the first time round. And by the way, I had an absolute blast making it. Great director, great co-stars, great script, terrific location. You should really only remake bad movies. It's easy to improve on failure. I do make some exceptions. I've allowed myself recently to do a little looking back. More and more I've been bumping into old friends and reflecting on the journeys we've each taken to bring us to these spots. When I was young and doing my first TV, I played a bit part in a police series called Dixon of Dock Green, opposite another struggling actor, a wonderful young Canadian called Donald Sutherland. Donald was a terrific and charismatic actor and great fun to be around. A few years later, as my career was just starting to take off, I was cast as Horatio in the BBC TV production of Hamlet. The director, Philip Saville, mentioned to me that he had finally, after some difficulty, managed to cast Fortinbras. He explained that though Fortinbras is a small part, who only comes in at the end when everyone else is dead, he has to command the show, in other words, to be a star. It's very difficult to find an actor with the right star quality who's prepared to play such a small part, he said. I asked who he'd found, and he told me, Donald Sutherland. Fast forward another 10 years, I was making The Eagle Has Landed with John Sturges, a great Hollywood director, and a wonderful British cast, including Jenny Agutter, Donald Pleasence, and Anthony Quayle, plus the great American actor Robert Duvall. And my co-star was Donald Sutherland, who by then had starred in MASH, Clute, opposite Jane Fonda, and Don't Look Now, opposite Julie Christie. We did, I admit, take a moment to look back on where we had come from, and to celebrate where we had both come to. My friendship with Donald was typical of how things work out in the movie business. You get to know people, become very close for a short time, and then because of the way the business works, you don't see each other for years. It's a friendship by time and location. So it was a nostalgic moment when, very recently, I was walking along the street in South Beach in Miami with my friend and heart doctor, Richard Berger, and I pointed out to Richard the block of flats where I used to live. "Do you know who lives there now?" he said. "Donald Sutherland." In my latest movie, King of Thieves, I appear along with many old friends, Ray Winston, Michael Gambon, Jim Broadbent. But maybe the one who gives me the most pleasure, Tom Courtney. We were both young working-class out-of-work actors together in the 1950s and 60s. Tom broke through with Angry Young Man, Alan Sillitoe's The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, Billy Liar, and Dr. Zhivago, just as I was breaking through with Zulu, Alfie, and Ipcrestfar. We came together again in Last Orders in 2001, and here we were now, with a knighthood each, playing a couple of thieves. The older I have become, the more moments like this have arisen, and the more I have been tempted by opportunities to look back. And the biggest temptation of all came in the form of My Generation, a documentary about Britain in the 60s and the people who made it. Doing the interviews for the documentary was a great opportunity for me to reconnect with old friends like Paul McCartney and Twiggy, who I hadn't seen since the 1960s. We had all pursued our fabulous new lives and lost touch or died. One old friend I regretted not being able to include in the documentary was George Harrison. He lived just down the road from us near Henley at one stage, and we used to go to each other for dinner. One time he brought his guitar and we all sat there eating our dinner in a state of great excitement, thinking he was going to sing for us. After dinner I said, "I see you brought your guitar, George." "No, it's not a guitar, Michael." "What is it then?" I said. "I saw you bring something in." "It's a ukulele," he said. "I'm the president of the George Formby Society." And then he gave us a whole concert as George Formby. George Harrison in my dining room, doing Leaning on a Lamppost, and When I'm Cleaning Windows. But more than that, it was important to me to document this moment in history when the British working class became their own masters. At the time, we didn't have a plan. We weren't organized. We didn't feel part of a movement. We just did what we wanted to do and took no notice of people who said we couldn't. And it turned out for me and people like me to be a liberation. It was the best decade ever. It was when everything changed and everything became possible. I wanted to try and capture all of that before those who spent the 1960s looking back in anger got too old to remember. This is the kind of looking back that I do allow myself to make sense of the past and of everything that has happened. Chapter 15. Getting Old and Staying Young. The other day I was minding my own business, having a quiet dinner in a restaurant, when someone approached me with the look I recognized. He had spotted me and wanted a quick word. I looked up from my French onion soup and smiled. "Are you Michael Caine?" "Yes, I am," I said. "Bloody hell," he shot back. "I thought you were fucking 100. That's a backhanded compliment, if ever there was one. "I know I'm old, but I don't feel old. Not in my head, where it matters. I forget all the time how old I am. It seemed like about 5 years ago I was 35. So I take things on that I shouldn't. I accept scripts. I wheel manure around in the garden. I nearly rupture myself every day. Age to me is in the mind. I've seen 70-year-olds who are already dead and 90-year-olds who can't stop themselves living. I stay young by refusing to be old. The only time I really feel old is when I catch sight of my stand-in on set. A stand-in is someone the same height and build as an actor whose job it is to stand and walk about on the set in the actor's place for the hours it takes to get the lighting right. When I first started work, my stand-in was a good-looking young guy and we became friends. Now, I see a poor, decrepit old man being helped out of his seat and almost carried to the camera position, and with a jolt, I realize that's my stand-in. That's me. just like I didn't do what I was supposed to in the 1940s and 1950s, when as a working-class lad I was expected to know my place and go and be a fish porter. I don't do what I'm supposed to do now, that I'm 85. I'm expected to know my place and sink gracefully back into my sofa, but I don't want to sit down. I don't want to retire. I want to keep on going. I'm expected to despise old age and yearn for those golden years of my youth, but I don't do that either, and I suspect I'm not alone in that. Of course, aging brings disappointments and inconveniences, frustrations and indignities, even despair, as weddings and birthday parties give way to hospital visits and memorial services. But it also brings its own joys and even occasionally a little wisdom. I look at aging not as a problem, but as a privilege, as the old joke goes. And it isn't really a joke. I can never forget the early death of my father and my childhood friend Paul Challen, who never truly enjoyed good health his entire life and died much too young, of my fellow struggling actors from the early days who gave up on life entirely, of burning talents like James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, Heath Ledger, who were extinguished too soon. It's better than the alternative. My approach to old age is in many ways like my approach to youth. I still use the difficulty and I still look for the good in bad situations and I still keep striving to do what I love. I enjoy each year so much that as each one slips past, I think, I'll have another one of those, please. One of the toughest challenges of getting older is that, first of all, your idols and mentors get old and die. That's tough. And then, even worse, your friends get old, and some of them go and die as well. But I still maintain there is no difficulty so great that it cannot be used. And so, though each blow has been harsh, I have eventually been able to use each terrible loss to remind me to enjoy the living and to enjoy my life. My great hero, John Huston, died of pneumonia in 1987 at the age of 81. He was funny to the last. At an awards ceremony shortly before he died, he was described as a living legend, John Huston. In reply, John Huston said, "My doctors assure me that that status will change with the first wintry blast." I had actually said goodbye to John once already, several years earlier. I had heard the sad news that he was on his deathbed. Sean Connery and I rushed to the Cedar Sinai Hospital in Hollywood to say goodbye. And when we got there, he was rambling. "I was in a boxing match," he said. "And it turns out the other guy had razors sewn in his gloves, and that's why I'm here." John went on about the boxer for 20 minutes, and then Sean and I looked at each other. And we were both in tears. We left the hospital very upset. And then we heard that John had got up and made 2 more movies. When I saw him, I said, "The next time I come to say farewell to you, you better bloody die, or I'll bloody kill you." "Do you know how upset we were?" John replied, "Well, Michael, you know, people get upset, and people die." "Yes," I said, "but not twice." But I was dreadfully upset, of course, the second time John died. He had been an idol of mine, a great supporter of my career, and a wonderful director to work with, and one of the truly great talents of his era. I met most of my closest friends in London during the late 1950s and 1960s. Over the years, we came to know each other, trust each other, appreciate each other, even love each other. We, Mayfair orphans, as we named ourselves, all led busy lives, but whenever we could, we met for lunch or dinner. There were 10 of us, but now all but 4 of us are dead. The nightclub host, Johnny Gold, the composer, Leslie Bricus, the photographer, Terry O'Neill, and me. I miss them all terribly. My press agent, Theo Cohen, who's one of the funniest men I've ever come across, with a quiet sadness about him. If you ask him how he was, he'd say, "The hard ones first, eh?" Theo went in the same understated way he had lived his life, settling down for a nap in his office after lunch and never waking up. It was a harsh reminder to us fun-loving Mayfair orphans that our fun was not going to last forever. As one of our group said at his funeral, they started bowling in our alley. But Theo was older than the rest of us, and at first the balls came at mercifully long intervals. When I lost my agent, Dennis Selinger, in 1998, I lost not only an agent, but a great guide, counsellor, and friend. Dennis had assured us that his cancer was curable, but perhaps, for the first time in his life, he was wrong. Or perhaps, I now wonder, He had sensed the truth, but he was being a good agent and true friend to the last. He must have known that the only way I would go to Hollywood to make my movie was if I thought I'd be coming back and seeing him again. There is still a huge Dennis-shaped hole in my life. Mickey Most, the record producer, was the fittest of us all, and we joked that he really must be sick when he cut his daily run down to 5 miles a day. It was a terrible shock to find out he actually was with virulent and incurable lung cancer, caused by the asbestos in the sound studios where he had worked all his life. The last time I saw Mickey, we both knew that we would never see each other again, but we laughed all the way through lunch. It started when I asked him what the doctor had actually said to him, and he said, I asked him, how long have I got? And he said, put it this way, don't send out any dry cleaning. I was still wiping the tears from my eyes as we hugged and parted outside the restaurant. I turned back for one last look, and he had disappeared around the corner of Berkeley Square by the Rolls-Royce showroom. I was crying, but knowing Mickey, he was still probably laughing. That was 2003, and Mickey was just 64. 5 years later, we lost Doug Haywood, our tailor and our dear friend, known to us all as the Buddha of Mount Street. It was because Doug would only ever give himself an hour off for lunch that we used to meet in Mayfair and dubbed ourselves the Mayfair Orphans, although these days it's more often the River Cafe. But Doug had left us years before that, his razor-sharp brain ravaged by the cruel indignities of Alzheimer's. When someone has Alzheimer's, you know they're going, but they take such a long time to go. With Doug, for me, it was like he was walking out of my life over the horizon and taking 3 years over it. One day I went to see him in his flat above the shop, and he was sitting watching television. Hello, Doug, I said. He turned and looked at me and said, hello. Then he turned back to the television. That was when I understood that Doug was never coming back. Someone up there obviously got his eye in, and we started falling like ninepins. In 2016, we lost trichologist Philip Kingsley, who had always ensured that there was not a dandruff-ridden or bald orphan amongst us. And less than a year later, Roger Moore. Roger was one of the most genuine, trustworthy, and generous people I have ever met. I first met him just after I'd made The Compartment in 1961, when he was already famous for his TV show, The Saint, and I was very much not. I was walking along Piccadilly with Terence Stamp, and we were thrilled to spot his suave, debonair figure stalking down the street in the opposite direction. He crossed the road towards us, and we looked around to see if somebody was behind us, but no. He came up to us, smiling, and said, "Are you Michael Caine?" I said I was. "I saw you in The Compartment, and I just want to tell you you're going to be a big star." Roger shook my hand and walked away. And I didn't see him again for another 5 or 6 years, by which time his prediction had come true. But it was a huge boost for me at the time, and a memorable start to nearly 60 years of friendship. Then in 2017, one bright spring evening, the sun was pouring through the windows when our friend Leslie Brickers called us from his house in the south of France to tell us that Roger had just died. He had been sick for a while, so it was not a surprise, but it was still a shock. And it still hurt. An hour later, Leslie called again to say that one of my closest Hollywood friends, Jerry Parencio, the kindest and most charitable rich man I had ever met, had just died. I was stunned with sadness. "Leslie, don't take this the wrong way," I said. "I love you, but I really don't want to speak to you again tonight." I went to bed and unplugged the phone. I've seen people go fast, like Mickey and Theo, and I've seen people go slow, like Dougie. Both ways have their cruelties for the individual and for those around him. But I know what I want. I want to live a long life like Roger, work to the end like Dennis, laugh my way through lunch like Mickey, and then die in my sleep like Theo. It is desperately sad when your family and friends start dying and your close circle gets smaller and smaller. It can be hard to find a way to use the difficulty, and each successive death does not get any easier to bear. I have, though, found that as our little group has become smaller and smaller, it has also become closer and closer. I have also enjoyed getting to know my friends' widows better than I did when their husbands were alive. Yet another cabbie also made the point to Alec Guinness in his own inimitable London cabbie way that as everyone else your age fades away, there's less and less competition for the good parts. That was many years ago. The great British actors Anthony Quayle, Rex Harrison and Laurence Olivier had all died in quick succession. "Are you an actor?" the cabbie said. "I am," said Alec. "Dropping like flies, aren't you?" I'm sure he didn't mean to sound unkind, and I don't wish to either, but the harsh fact